Members, we will call this meeting of the Commerce Committee to order. And I know it's everybody's favorite part of the meeting, but we are not going to have minutes today. We had a computer malfunction.
Oh.
So we will have the meetings. I know. Sorry. We'll have yesterday's minutes will be available at our next committee hearing. We're having technical, or I think they're fixed. We were having technical difficulties. So we have no minutes, but almost as good, we have Representative Davids with a bill. Representative Davids, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move House File 2342, and it would be going to the General Register if the committee.
That is my understanding. Thank you, Representative Davids. Representative Davids moves House File 2342. Representative Davids, do you want to have Mr. Marshall or your other testifier speak?
I'd like to introduce the bill if I could, and I believe, is there an amendment that we have to the bill?
We have the A120726 amendment.
I'd move that amendment to get.
Do you want to do that immediately? Okay, Representative Davids has moved the bill. Do you want to explain briefly what the very brief amendment does?
Sure, I'll have Mr. Marsh do that.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Marcus Marsh with the Farm Mutual. That makes the bill effective the day after an enactment. That was the intent of putting that in the bill initially.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Marsh. Representative Davids, members, any questions to the brief amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A120726 amendment is adopted. Representative Davids or Mr. Marsh or...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'll introduce the bill here and what we're trying to do, and then I've got a couple quick testifiers in support of the bill. House File 2342 has to do with Township Mutual Insurance Companies. Township Mutual Insurance Companies out in rural Minnesota are a real bedrock institution. Over the years, as many larger insurance companies would have nothing to do with writing farm insurance, the Township Mutuals were there to take care of those risks and folks to the farmers and folks in rural Minnesota. For many years, Township Mutuals are governed under Chapter 67A. And in Chapter 67A, you can take a look back on a claim of a year. The courts ruled in a case under the section of law 65A where you have regular homeowners. What Township Mutuals do to insure a lot of their members is they'll have combination policies where you put fire, wind, liability all together. The homeowners portion of that is to be governed under Chapter 67A, not 65A. In a recent court case, the judges put the homeowners, there was a Township Mutual portion of the policy under Chapter 65A and ruled against the Township Mutuals. And this just simply clarifies that it's already in law that Township Mutuals are to be governed under 67A. And this is one of those bills that says we really mean it. The courts got it wrong on this, and this is to clarify a wrong that the courts engaged in, and it'll just be very clear where Township Mutual law is.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Do you, Mr. Marsh, do you want to speak to this?
Yeah, I will make one or two quick comments, introduce the folks that are here to testify. First of all, just to clarify on what Representative Davids said, our homeowners follow 65A, same as everybody else. It's the farm policy that is the question, not the homeowners, the farm policy.
That's correct. I apologize.
And so I have Mr. Paul Woken, who's our legal counsel with Willenbring, Dahl, and Woken in Cold Spring. He'll be carrying most of the testimony. And then Mikkel, you want to raise your hand? Stand up. Mikkel Nelson, who's also on our Government Affairs Committee and on the policy committee and manager of one of our companies, here is here as a reference if there's a policy question. So with that, Mr. Chairman, other than mentioning that we insure somewhere between 70 and 80% of all the farms across Minnesota, one of our member 93 farm mutuals. And this issue, as we get into it, you'll see, is a very big issue relating to greater Minnesota and farms in particular in agriculture. So I just want to make that mention, and we have met with the Commissioner of Commerce. I think they are still reviewing the issue, but we had a very good meeting with Commissioner Rothman. We always meet with the department prior to doing anything, and so I just want to make sure that people are clear on that issue. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Paul Wolken.
Thank you, Mr. Marsh. Mr. Wolken, welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself for the tape, we'd appreciate it, and please proceed when you're ready.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Wolken. I'm legal counsel for the Township Mutuals in Minnesota. I practice and live in Cold Spring, Minnesota, which is in western Stearns County. I want to thank the members of the committee for allowing us to come here today, and I'll keep my remarks short. You have a fairly large agenda to appear, so I'll try and be brief. The bill that's before the committee here for your consideration is intended to clarify the Minnesota Statute 67A-191. I want to emphasize that the proposed revisions under this bill do not seek to change any existing law or regulation in Minnesota, nor are the proposed revisions in any way intended to implement any new law or regulation. As we just heard, 67A is a section of Minnesota statutes that is devoted and governs the township mutual industry in Minnesota, and those township mutuals are limited in terms of the kinds of insurance they can write and where they can issue policies. Essentially, the township mutuals write fire and theft coverage and then package their policies with a statewide carrier, which provides the wind and the liability coverage that the township mutuals by statute are not permitted to write. Unlike statewides, township mutuals are regulated in that way. Now, the revision that is proposed under this bill under subdivision 1 would simply clarify current law by specifically stating that the portion of a combination policy issued by a township mutual on qualified property, and that's the property under current Minnesota law that township mutuals are permitted to write, the township mutuals would issue policies on qualified property, and that statute currently defines qualified property as including dwellings or houses. So the notion that the amended portion of that sentence in subdivision 1, which emphasizes that qualified property includes dwellings and that township mutuals may insure dwellings and be exempt from the insurance laws in Minnesota, is not a new concept in Minnesota law. And in fact, under 67A.14 subdivision 1, the statute defines qualified property as follows. It's one sentence. Qualified property means dwellings, household goods, appurtenant structures, farm buildings, farm personal property, churches, church personal property, etc. So the effect of this amendment is to basically incorporate a provision that's already found in 67A.141 into 67A.191 and to offer that clarification. The proposed amendment to subdivision 2 is basically intended to provide the exact same clarification in a case when a township mutual decides to issue what is referred to under subdivision 2 of the statute, a homeowner's policy. So it is the intent to again reference that the combination policy issued by the township mutual, if it's on a dwelling, that portion would be exempt from the requirements of the insurance laws of the state of Minnesota. Now, the revision contained in this bill was prompted, as was mentioned earlier, by a court case. The Court of Appeals issued a decision on January 13th, but I want to underscore that if the bill with the revisions in it were passed, it would not affect the outcome of this case or the litigation that currently is under appeal. In the district court, judge in this particular case granted summary judgment, ruling that this was a classic township mutual farm combination policy under subdivision 1, not subject to the homeowner's requirements under subdivision 2. That ruling was appealed to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals ruled that the dwelling portion of any township mutual policy constituted homeowner's insurance under subdivision 2. And that's the result that we disagree with and that we hope to correct with these revisions and with the appeal that we have before the Supreme Court right now. So the essence is, in terms of these revisions, is to clarify existing case law and policy in the statute, and we're hopeful that the committee would pass the bill and offer the Township Mutuals the kind of guidance and the principles that they've relied upon in their writing their insurance in the farm market as they've done in the past. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkins.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davids.
What he said is what I meant to say.
Representative Davids, we knew that. Members, any questions? Is there anyone else that you gentlemen want to have come down and testify for this? Is there anyone in the audience that wants to come down and testify against the bill? Please come on up if you...
Mr. Chair, Mr. Rogers, would like to respond when they're done.
That's not a good sign.
Please come on up, take a seat. If you could identify yourself for the record, have a seat, and then please proceed whenever you're ready. And welcome to the committee, by the way. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, my name is David White. My last name is spelled W-E-I-D-T. I'm an attorney from from Minneapolis. I represented Michael Caesar and Sharon Betzinger in the case that has been mentioned previously in the testimony. This was an incident where the my clients purchased insurance through a Township Mutual Insurance Company. The house that they insured on their farm was subsequently destroyed by fire approximately 2 to 3 years after they bought the policy. Prior to buying the policy, the insurer sent someone to the house, did an evaluation of the house, put a valuation on the house, and that was the amount of insurance that was placed on the house. Under Minnesota Statute 65A, which is the normal fire insurance policy, when you have a complete loss, a total loss, the amount that's payable to the homeowner is the face value of the policy. In this case, the amount was $557,300. During the period that the policy was in force, the insurer came to the house on one occasion, did a complete inspection again, raised the value. It was originally somewhere in the $400,000 range. It was raised up to $557,300. This is a policy that was determined by the Court of Appeals to be, under its plain language, a homeowner's policy, and thus subject to Minnesota Statute 67A.191, Subdivision 2, which says that it's governed under Statute 65A, which includes two main portions that are applicable to this case. One being that there's a 2-year statute of limitations. The second being that in the event of a total loss, this is what's called the value policy law, in the event of a total loss, that the homeowner is entitled to the entire face value of the policy, $557,300. What happened was that the insurer came out, valued the home, wrote the policy, the homeowners paid the policy premiums. When there was a loss, the insurer came back and said, no, this is not covered under the value policy law. This is covered under the terms of our policy, which is subject to exceptions if there is an exception under the state statute. There is an exception under the state statute, thus the dispute between the homeowners and their insurer. Let me talk a little bit about what this value policy is. As I said, it says that in the event of a total loss, you're entitled to the total policy limit. This is not some new and radical idea that's come along recently. The value policy laws are in effect in 20 states of the 50 states right now. The first value policy law was passed in Wisconsin in 1874. It's in fact in effect in Minnesota. It's in effect in Wisconsin, North and South Dakota. It's been the law in Minnesota since 1967. The law that's in effect today has not changed one word since 1967. The reason for the value policy law, there's several reasons. The most prominent in this case is that it allows the insurer and the homeowner to evaluate the value of the property when the property is there to be looked at, not after it's burned down, not when it's a heap of ashes laying in a hole. What happened here is that the insurer came back and said, no, no, you're not covered under the value policy law. This is not a homeowner's policy. You're entitled to the actual cash value, which is the language that's used in their own policy. Another purpose of the value policy law is that, having established the value of the house, if it's a total loss, you should be paid virtually immediately, within a matter of days. There was no dispute as to whether it was a total loss. There was no dispute as to how the fire happened or anything of the sort. The only issue was valuation. And the insurance company then entered into an investigation as to the value. 3 months after the fire, they made an initial offer to the homeowners. It didn't offer them what they were entitled to under the value policy law. They offered them $361,000. That's $196,000 less than their policy limit. It's 65% of their policy limit. The homeowners refused that. Negotiations continued. Eventually, on March 18th, 2009, this is 11 months after the fire, 1 month before the running of what's claimed to be the 1 year statute of limitations, there was an appraisal that was conducted under the terms of the policy. This is what's like an arbitration. There were three appraisers, one appointed by each party, the third one appointed by the two other appraisers. They came to an actual cash value of $445,000. That's $112,000 less than the policy limit and 80% of the coverage that the insureds had bought and paid for. The insureds received that money at that time. They rebuilt their house. They rebuilt their house in a much smaller and more basic fashion than it had been prior to the fire. As a result of the expense and the smaller recovery that they made, they were also required to bear the expenses of the appraisal process, the expenses of delay, and the discomfort of delay. The insurers have estimated to me that had they received the policy limits in a prompt and manner as they normally should have, their house would have been rebuilt and they could have been back to a normal life within about 6 months. As it is, they lived in a travel trailer in their driveway on their farm while they actively operated a farm for 18 months. There's been implications made to the committee that if this bill is not enacted into law, that there are some financial problems or financial issues or some dire consequences that will come to the Township Mutual industry. We haven't heard anything about what they are. The Township Mutual industry, despite its exemption from insurance laws, does report their financial results to the Department of Commerce. The Department of Commerce issues reports. What I believe to be the most recent report for the year ending in 2010 indicates that they have income from total written premiums. This is for the entire 93 companies of $73 million. Their loss ratio, in other words, their payout for what they pay for losses, is about 50%. So there's $36 million that goes to the expenses of running the company, I would assume, and what profits they're made, what distributions there might be to their members. But the idea that these companies cannot exist unless they offer their policyholders a lower level of coverage than is required by 65A, and it is available to every other homeowner in Minnesota who has a homeowner's policy. Just simply, if that's the case, it hasn't been explained to the committee. As Mr. Watkin said, this case right now is pending before the Minnesota Supreme Court. They will have all of the information that's necessary to make a decision. The Court of Appeals has been presented to the committee that the Court of Appeals made a mistake, that they didn't understand what they were doing when they said that this is a homeowner's policy and that they're entitled to the benefits of 65A, according to what the Court of Appeals termed the plain language of 67A.191 subdivision 2. As I said, the Supreme Court has been presented with a petition by the Township Mutuals to review this. They haven't made a decision as to whether they think it's appropriate or whether the Court of Appeals will stand. This idea that the Township Mutuals should have the right, despite the plain language of the statute, to simply ignore that and go to somebody whose house has burned down and tell them, without regard to the statute, this is what you're going to get. This is not the intention of the legislature. This is not the intention of the legislature in 1994 when they put in this subdivision 2, which says it's subject to 65A. This whole scheme, if you would like to call it that, reminds me of a good friend of mine, David Brackett, who's in the insurance business. He's made a career based on integrity and service. He told me one time, I can offer much better coverage at a much lower cost if I reserve the right not to pay the claim. And that's what's really has gone on with my clients and what's going on with everybody who has a total loss fire under one of these policies when they choose to simply ignore the statute that's been in effect since 1994.
Thank you, Mr. White. Any questions from members? Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. White, 17 years since the adoption. Is this the first impression that a district court has had or the Court of Appeals has had relative to this specific issue?
I don't know the answer to that. I think it appears that it is. There's clearly been no Court of Appeals ruling that's been exactly on point, but Mr. Watkin could probably answer that more than I.
Representative Atkins?
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. White, that because I'm troubled by that. I mean, it would strike me that if, in fact, you know, just the straight-up approach of, you know, applying common sense would be that somebody during that 17 years, what I'm doing is playing a little devil's advocate with what you've said, is that at some point somebody would have lit that issue up and brought it at least before a district court, and my sense is that it would have been a case of first impression. The Township Mutuals would have appealed it then, so we would have had at least a Court of Appeals, if not a Supreme Court decision, on point. So I suspect this is the way it's been taking place. For you don't take issue with the fact that this is how it's been interpreted by the Township Mutuals and the homeowners, whether they liked it or not, have been settling claims this way for 17 years.
My impression is,
Mr. White, please work through the chair.
I'm sorry,
Mr. White.
My impression is that the Township Mutuals have interpreted it to their benefit, and that the homeowners have not had the opportunity to go through the process as we have, and take it to a district court and then take it to the appellate court. Now, as I said, Mr. Watkin can address that issue more than I can, but the Court of Appeals clearly described this as the plain language of the policy. And in the Court of Appeals, Mr. Watkin was asked the question, if the appellates in this case, which was myself and my clients, aren't correct in their proposed application of this, What was the purpose of the legislation when it was passed? And Mr. Watkins suggested that the purpose of it was to apply to houses that are owned by a farmer but not on a farm. The Court of Appeals rejected that, saying that there was no authority for that, and that there was nothing presented by the Township Mutual that suggested anything other than the interpretation that was adopted by the Supreme Court. By the Court of Appeals.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. White. I look forward to hearing the response from the Township Mutuals. I am generally, and I'm sure most legislators are, very reluctant to get involved in pending litigation, which this is.
Yeah.
But that being said, you know, we've had 17 years where it's been interpreted all in one fashion. So I at least wanted to hit you between the eyes with that question, and then we'll see what the response is from the people who brought the legislation.
Representative Atkins, I think it's a good question and a good idea. And Mr. Watkins or Mr. Marsh, if you want to come back up and give us your side of this, come on up.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Do I get a chance to speak?
I'm sorry. Yes, you do. If you want to go ahead, please identify yourself for the tape and please proceed. But members and guests, you speak as long as you'd like. We're running a little long on this one particular bill, so let's try to keep answers as narrow as we can. And if you can, please tell us your story, but if you can avoid covering things that others have already hit, and I would say that to the other side as well, we would appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, my name is Michael Caesar. I was the homeowner in this particular case. To sum it up short and keep it sweet, I am not as eloquent as my attorney is on all the technical things, so I'm going to just hit you right between the eyes like the chairman has mentioned. I was a dairy farmer. We had a beautiful house. We had a policy with the Township Mutual Company for many years. Our house was robbed and burned on April 8th of 2008. We set in forth the motion, just like my attorney said, everything else. We followed all their rules, played by their games. For 18 months, we lived in a camper trailer and ran the farm out of a camper trailer. I don't know how many of you have ever camped in a camper trailer for a weekend and then planned on living in it for 18 months. We finally went to appraisal, and they agreed upon $445,000. In my opinion, and I'm bullheaded on this, and that's why I pushed this with my attorney to go all the way. They wrote me a policy for $557,000. I had that stuck into the house. It was, in my opinion, it was still undervalued for the size of the house and everything else. That is not my issue. I'm not complaining about that. What I am complaining about, they wrote me a policy for $557,000. They only paid $447,000 and change on that policy. Now, if I'm paying a policy for a $500,000 home to cover me in case anything should happen, shouldn't I be paid the full amount of that policy? Instead, what they did to myself, and they did to other homeowners, I don't know if that's for a fact, but what part of fraud don't you see in that? In my opinion, they're writing policies that they will never pay, and you are paying the full policy limits. It kind of hurts, you know, to be thinking that you are completely covered for everything that you have in that home. I mean, I had antiques from my grandparents that I later found out in that policy was not covered. You know, I, as a farmer and everything else, everybody else has a busy schedule. Do you have time to sit down and read your policy cover to cover and see what you're actually covered for? And when you go through it and then you do have a fire and you lose everything you have and you find out nothing is actually covered, that really hurts. My attorney made very good points on everything here. The Court of Appeals has also covered their part. Like I said, I'm not getting into the legal aspect of this. But when you have a policy written by a company stating for exactly what you're covered for the $557,000 of your home, and you find out they're only going to pay you 80%, but yet you're paying the full policy limits, what part of literally being messed over would you take it? There's, I mean, I live in a very simple world. Simply, we're up north, northern Minnesota. You know, everything is pretty laid back up there. When you get screwed over, you've got to draw a line in the sand and say, hey, how far is this going to keep going? And who else is going to be hurt by this all the way straight through? You got to start standing up for your rights against these companies. It gets to a fact is, okay, they have 93 companies. Out of these 93 companies, who are they all doing this to? You know, they keep upping the premiums, but they know they will never pay on them premiums because they're governed by a law that is protected by a law 60, 70 years old in the state of Minnesota that has never been changed to protect the homeowners and the policyholders that are paying their way. On that, thank you very much. That's all I have to say.
Mr. Cedar, I will correct you on one thing. I think you were very eloquent, so you did a nice job. Members, any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, can we reserve the right to respond?
Well, within the reason, the limits of time, and I will say this to everybody here, we're the Commerce Committee. We're not trying a case here, and we're letting you have a lot more latitude than we normally would because that's substantially why we're here for this bill, and I appreciate that, and I think you both sides have done a nice job. So,
thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Watkin, if you want to reply, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief. I don't want to try the case here either because I'm going to be doing that hopefully in a couple of months in the Supreme Court. First of all, I'd like the committee to know in terms of the posture of the case, the Mr. White and Mr. Sisar have tried to frame the issue as one of whether value policy law should apply to township mutuals, and that's really not the issue here. That's a political fight or debate for another day and time, but that's not the issue in this case. It was interesting in this case, though, and I think the committee should know that the homeowner had coverage of $557,300 on the house, and when the house burned down, the claim wasn't made on value policy amount. It was made for $515,000. So the demand against the insurance company was not based on what the insurance policy stated as the limit, but what they thought the value of the home was. Now, there was a dispute on that. It went to appraisal in accordance with the law and the regulations and the policy language, and an independent appraisal determined the value, which was paid promptly by the Township Mutual in accordance with law and the policy provisions. With respect to the question that was raised earlier about court cases or this issue coming up earlier, I will tell the committee that I've had, I would venture to say, approximately 30 summary judgment arguments that I've made over the years to various district courts in Minnesota as to the applicability of the one-year policy period of limitation as opposed to the two-year policy period of limitation imposed by 65A. And I can tell you that I've had two cases that have been rejected. All other cases in district court rulings have ruled that 67A governs the township mutuals. They're exempt from the insurance laws for good reason because they can't write, they can't insure as other insurers do, and so that one-year policy period of limitation has been upheld in a number of instances. And I would also add to the committee member that this very same issue was argued by me in front of the Court of Appeals in the case of Jacobson versus Northstar in 2004, where the issue again was, is it a one-year or two-year, and does 67A apply to a farm combination policy that we have here? And the court upheld the district court ruling in that case and ruled that there was a one-year policy period of limitation and that that was reasonable and applicable to Township Mutuals in Minnesota. Unfortunately, that decision from the Court of Appeals was an unpublished opinion, and so it does not have precedent. It is only persuasive. But that very same issues were raised in that case, and in that instance, with a different panel in front of the court, we got a different result. That's one of the reasons committee members were here asking for clarification of the statute to avoid one panel saying one thing, another panel saying something else when these cases come before them. Finally, I would just note also that the argument that we should have valued policy law in Minnesota, again, is a political argument, but our Supreme Court has ruled on that issue also. In the case of Ehlert versus Grau in 1972, our Minnesota Supreme Court dealt with this issue, and they ruled that valued policy law does not apply to township mutuals. So, again, to summarize, the purpose of these revisions in this bill is to simply clarify the meaning of homeowners insurance, what a township mutual package policy is, that dwellings are included within the definition of qualified property, and if there is a loss with respect to that type of property, that loss is governed by 67A, not 65A. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walken. Members, any questions? Mr. White, do you want to come back up? And we are very close to being at a place where we're going to vote here. We're not going to keep going back and forth. Again, I appreciate the testimony from both sides. I think it is enlightening for members. But
one more statement.
By the way, I forgot to mention, when those claims were made by the property owner in this case, after the appraisal award was made, and the Township Mutual, within 5 days, accordance with the policy language, made payment as to what they were ordered to pay, inclusive of the personal property claim in this case, the household damage, and the additional living expense, the payment made by the Township Mutual in this case exceeded $800,000.
Thank you, Mr. Walken. Mr. White?
Justice,
welcome back. Please feel free to thank you, Representative Davids. We're up here wondering if we should need black robes. Mr. White, go ahead.
I would just like to say that the issue in this case is not the value policy law. It is the one-year statute of limitations, and it is the application of 65A. Ultimately, the value policy law is the jackpot question, because if 65A is applicable, then the two-year statute of limitations is applicable, and the value policy law is applicable. This issue having been gone to summary judgment motions on 30 occasions, there are a number of different issues that have to do with the applicability of 65A and the applicability of the Township Mutual policies. In this instance, the question was simply, is this a homeowner's policy that is clearly covered under 65A according to the statute that was passed in 1994. Mr. Walken quoted an appellate court case that predated the statute by over 20 years. In this instance, clearly, as the Court of Appeals said, this is the plain language of this statute that it is applicable. And Mr. Walken's comments about being paid $800,000 is to suggest to the committee that my clients are overreaching by asking to be paid the full value of their policy, which is what they bought, what was recommended to them, what they paid the premium on. And they are asking to get paid the part that was due to them, and they didn't get paid. And this bill is not going to be applicable to their case, according to the status of it right now. But it's going to be applicable to the next people, and the next people, and the next people. This has gone on now for 17 or 18 years, and there's no telling how many times this has happened to people. And that's the point of us being here today and of us bringing this up to the appellate court, because they're simply asking to get paid what they're entitled to under the plain language of the statute. I appreciate your attention.
Thank you, Mr. White. And I appreciate your testimony, Mr. Watkin, and everybody on this. Members, any questions? Representative Atkins.
Not for Mr. White, though, just for the chief author. I think Representative David's the one thing, I don't know who's going to win, but the one thing that these folks have convinced me of is that there's a heck of a question that's going to go to the Supreme Court, and that this is definitely pending litigation, and I'd appreciate your weighing in on, you've been here longer than I think any, no offense, but anybody I think who's sitting around the table.
Since before mud.
Well, you know, give or take. But are we, I don't recall ever literally getting in the middle of a pending case, and it sounds like this one is going to be hopefully heard according to the testifier in favor of the bill, hopefully heard by the Supreme Court in a couple months here. Do you recollect situations where we've done that?
Well, from what I understand, maybe Mr. Pender could help out here, but Mr. Chairman and Representative Atkins, I do not believe that this affects current cases. Mr. Pender, would this in any way affect a current case?
Mr. Pender.
Representative Davis, do you mean this? Whether this hearing would affect?
No, let's say this bill passes.
The passage of this bill.
I don't think this hearing will affect anything. But
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in my thousands of years here, I've never heard Mr. Pender say that.
Well, Representative Davids, I did check on this before the committee hearing, and the answer I got is that the assumption was that this bill, the passage of the bill, assuming it passes, would not impact the current court case, and I am not an attorney and I could be corrected, but that's my understanding. And I'm sure if that's not the case, you'll hear about this sometime in the very near future. Like that's probably in the next 10 or 15 minutes.
That's the way I understand it, Mr. Chairman. I'll stand corrected if I'm not correct.
Thank you. And Representative Atkins?
But the point is nonetheless the same. It's an issue that's before the Supreme Court, or is hopefully, according to the proponents, going to be before the Supreme Court. And traditionally, I don't know that this body has ever interfered with we've talked about it, but we've been very, very reticent to do it. And I don't think it makes sense to do it in this case. I also pulled the statute, and I can see why it is going to be before the Supreme Court, is because it is very, very plain that it says that these policies are subject to the provisions of Chapter 65A, as well as some other laws. So it certainly strikes me as an issue that's appropriately for the Supreme Court to decide, and that we probably ought to keep our noses out of until they figured it out. If you don't like the outcome then you bring the bill and you try to undo it, but it's not something that we should get our fingers involved in at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to come down and speak for or against the bill? Seeing nobody rushing down, yes, sir, please come down and join us. We would appreciate your comments, and as I said to the testifiers on both sides, we hope they are brief. Thank you, Mr. White. Yes, sir. Please identify yourself for the record. And
my name is Paul Norcia.
Okay.
Thank you for hearing me.
How do you spell your last name?
It's Norcia.
Okay.
I'm a licensed public insurance adjuster here in the state of Minnesota.
Okay.
And I'm not going to rehash anything that you've heard already, but my comment to this is that each of us here, I would hope, is a homeowner themselves. And in the event that you had a fire under your policy, or a total loss under your policy, you'd be paid the full value of that policy. That would be the case for anyone who wrote their policy through a regular property and casualty insurer and not through a township mutual. So, again, I think it's imperative that going forward, it specifically spells out, especially for a home that's used as a primary residence of any person in the state of Minnesota, should be covered under 65A. And it's already stated that way. So, very quickly, I would like to address some of the issues that Mr. Atkins brought up as to homeowners that might disappear or go away. These insureds are told again and again by insurance carriers, especially carriers that write farm policies and the township mutuals and four companies in the state that assist the township mutuals that, oh, we're not governed by that. We're not governed by statute of limitations of 1 year. We're not governed by the value policy law. I've seen it happen with fires. I've seen it happen with tornadoes. So the bill creates more insulation to avoid the accountability of insurance companies.
Thank you, Mr. Norshaw. Members, any questions?
Mr. Chair, this is was the motion Atkins. To send it to civil law, right?
The motion was to send it to the General Register. Representative Atkins, I asked about that, and I kind of got the same answer back that Mr. Pender just gave a moment ago. No one was sure about it, and if Representative Westrom wants it or if civil law wants to have it, they can request it. As long as it's not here, I'm fine with that. But we can, the motion originally was to send it to the General Register.
Mr. Chair, question for the chief author then. Representative David's civil law. Based on what we've heard in the testimony today,
that makes some sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Then I will, I can, or Representative David's can change your motion if that's okay with you.
Maybe if we could hear from Mr. Marsh real quick on that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Marsh.
Committee members, it's obviously the call of the Commerce Committee, and I dare not get mixing Senate and the House because it's two different animals. But
only Senate, one of us is an animal, Mr. Marsh.
The Senate didn't feel that it needed to. I know there's varying issues here, but again, I want to make crystal clear the committee members. Our homeowner's policy is a homeowner's policy, the same as everybody else. Our farm policy is unique. There's animals, there's pesticides, there's millions of dollars of equipment, there's numerous buildings, there's livestock. This is a policy that's been in place since the beginning of the farm mutuals. Not many companies want to do much business in Greater Minnesota with agriculture in the farms. There has not been a problem with this issue. There hasn't been a problem with this statute. There hasn't been any problem. You talk to the Department of Commerce about our member companies, and they will tell you, and I'll challenge anyone in the committee, they have said they get so few complaints about our member companies. Nobody has less complaints in the insurance industry than us. Nobody. We're local. We're captive Minnesota. We don't have any place to run and hide. You don't call Chicago or New York or Miami or Taiwan to talk about your claim. You go down the street. Now, you heard those folks were paid $820,000.
Mr. Marsh.
There's not, and I'm not trying to
Mr. Chairman, I'll move this bill to civil law.
But it's just a matter, Mr. Chairman, that there are issues that are far afield. We do a great job, and the issue is that we paid our responsible claims, and I hope the committee can support this bill, and if it goes to civil law, we'll take it up there.
Thank you, Mr. Marsh, and I think that I speak for the whole committee that we are supporters of the farm mutual companies, and I think no one more so than Representative Davids. Representative Davids at this point renews his motion that House File 2342, as amended, be recommended to pass and go to the Committee on Civil Law. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you, Representative Davids, and all the testifiers. Representative Creasel. I hardly ever say this, but I'm hoping you didn't bring samples.
Oh, they did.
Kirk, just enter. You want to move this bill? Are you going to be here? Representative Creasel, welcome to the Commerce Committee. We will have Representative Stensrud will move House File 1774 so that it is before us.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Stensrud. With that, Representative Creasel, please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1774 broadens the definition of fireworks that will be allowed to be sold in the state of Minnesota. Currently, the only fireworks sold in our state are ground-based sparklers, and we want to expand current law to include consumer fireworks. As we all know, many Minnesota residents enjoy using a full array of fireworks, both legal and illegal, especially during the 4th of July celebrations. We cannot and do not want to stop people from enjoying fireworks, but we can and do want to stop criminalizing these people. 46 states and the District of Columbia allow full consumer fireworks sales. Several states have found that once fireworks were made legal, injuries and fires were reduced. There are some examples in your packets. Right now, we're losing tax revenue to our neighboring states. Do you ever wonder why Wisconsin sells fireworks right across our border and yet does not sell them to Wisconsin residents, or at least does not make it easy to be purchased by Wisconsin residents? Clearly, they are there to serve their Minnesota neighbors and have been successful for many years. If you drive into Minnesota from South Dakota, as you near the border, you will see billboards advertising last chance fireworks. It is not the last chance for South Dakota residents, but for our residents driving into South Dakota looking for a little fun. Mr. Chair and members, I have some testifiers that will do better at explaining it. First, I was wondering if it would be okay with the committee if we did an oral amendment to change the effective date in there.
At the will of the committee, I think that's fine.
Okay. There's three places in there. Line 3.17, line 3.34, and line 4.20. It would be to amend the effective date from July 1st, 2012 to June 1st, 2012. This way we could get those businesses up and running this year.
That, in my time here, is probably the most interesting oral amendment I've seen. Members, any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, we will move the oral amendment to House File 1774. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The oral amendment is adopted, changing the date. Representative Creasel, we appreciate your testimony and your brevity, and please introduce your testifier. And, sir, if you could say your name for the record, start whenever you're ready.
My name is Gary Hansen. I am a principal member of the NFPA, and that's an acronym for National Fire Prevention Association. I am on the pyrotechnics and high-powered rocketry and amateur rocketry. I've been writing fireworks code for 18 years, and that includes all the venues. Indoor, if you've ever seen the indoor fireworks for all the big venues, concerts, whatever, state fair, inside, outside. Also, I sit in as an expert witness for the high-pressured gas, if you've ever seen the big flames coming up when races get over, that sort of thing. And I've been fortunate enough to sit on those committees for 18 years, and there is a chapter, and the NFP Code 1124 has Chapter 7, which has to deal with the venue of consumer fireworks sales, and it pretty much covers everything there is. All venues, including structures, temporary structures, tents, the whole thing. There's a code for it. It covers everything from where you can park your vehicles to generators. The whole thing is covered in there. The people that sit on this committee are very diverse, a bunch of people. We have BATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Fireworks and Explosives sit on that committee. The CPSC, Consumer Product Safety Commission, sits on this. The U.S. DOT, the U.S. Coast Guard, all the acronyms out of Washington, D.C. sits on these committees and makes sure that we all do the same thing to make sure that it's controlled and done in a legal fashion. The consumer fireworks are actually controlled by the CPSC and the U.S. DOT as to what's legal in the United States to be used as consumer fireworks. And their limit is the federal limit. And that is not being allowed to be sold in this state right now. It is in all the states around the Dakotas and Wisconsin. Those states are allowed to sell all that consumer fireworks. So there is a code for it. It's been done very good. The injury rate has gone down significantly. The usage of pyrotechnics for the consumer has just about doubled every year. And the injury rate has doubled down every year. In other words, they're going away from each other. So the usage is going up, the injury rate has gone down. And I think the last time there was an injury rate of 9,000, which is an extrapolated figure by incidents, and so there's a multiplication factor of people being injured. So that is not a real number. So.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Members, any questions?
Mr. Just a clarification.
Representative Atkins.
To either the chief author or the witness, we talk about Wisconsin a lot. What's their injury rate for these sorts of fireworks?
I don't hear very good. Sorry.
Wisconsin injury rate.
Oh, I don't know what the Wisconsin injury rate. I'm sorry, I can't. I tried getting that information. I also, by the Freedom of Information, to get that and the tax revenue, and they said it's not open to the public. So.
Okay. So when Mr. Chair, to the author, when Wisconsinites use these same fireworks that Minnesotans go over the border and buy, we don't know what their injury rate is when they set them off in Wisconsin?
Representative Kreisel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, I could not find that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Is there anyone else that wants to come down and speak for or against this bill? I see Mr. Espenson is here, or Chief Espenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen.
Thank you.
Welcome to our committee. Please identify yourself for the record and start whenever ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Gerard Associates representing Phantom Fireworks. They are one of the nation's leading retailers of consumer fireworks. And we actually want to share our concerns with the legislation in its current form. And we appreciate the opportunity. We've talked quite a bit with Representative Kreisel. Appreciate his position, but want to give you a little bit different perspective about where Phantom Fireworks is coming from. We actually support the expansion of the types of consumer fireworks permitted for sale and use in Minnesota, the type that Representative Kreisel is talking about. Phantom would like to expand their stores in Minnesota, but also believe that the expansion of fireworks should be done thoughtfully and carefully in the safest manner possible, and that is why we are concerned. Particularly allowing the unrestricted sale of the full line of consumer fireworks in tents. And what the amendment that Phantom Fireworks had brought to the Crime Prevention Committee would have required a permanent structure. Think about maybe what you've seen in Wisconsin, where they have a more permanent structure where actually the state law specifies aisle width.
Ms. Cook, hang on. Sorry to interrupt you. 1 second. If somebody's got their cell phone or whatever, we get interference from the mics, as everybody could hear. So whoever just stopped doing what they're doing, thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no problem.
Ms. Cook?
A tent does not have the same safety and containment features as a permanent structure. So with a tent, you can imagine you might have danger to adjacent structures, vehicles, people. Especially considering tents are frequently found in parking lots or in vicinities of high traffic areas. Consumers may not be familiar with the risk that they might encounter should an accident or somebody purposely do something in a tent. You know when you go into these structures what you're dealing with. It's a fireworks store and you know what's there. We also had requirements for things like providing safety information, and working with the state fire marshal and those types of things. So, again, as I said, think about maybe the kind of structures you might see in Wisconsin. And the other concern we have is that the current version of the bill, I believe that it references the NFPA 1124, the 2003 version, and we're not quite clear why you wouldn't reference 2006, which is the most current edition. And that is the only comprehensive consumer fireworks code and safety standard that exists today. And it does include more detail in terms of the requirements for sales venues and helps with enforcement efforts, applies greater separation distances for temporary facilities and their surroundings. So that's just a thing we did want to point out because the 2003 is a little deficient in that area from what I understand. And the final thing I want to say is that as the Commerce Committee, the state regulates a number of products that we all use, and some of them are a lot of fun when used properly, dangerous when not. And so your job is to really look at what the appropriate regulations and requirements for the sale and use of various products are. And we're just suggesting that you may want to take another look at the best way for sales of this type of fireworks as a little different from what Representative Kriesel has in front of you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Members, any questions?
Just one, Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this, Ms. Cook, is this your handout, or Ms. Chief Author, is this, do you know who this?
That's ours, Mr. Chair. Or Mr. Chair. Okay. Representative
then
Atkins.
Then I guess just a quick question. It's very, very persuasive that there's more injuries from soccer than there are from fireworks. I'm curious how many kids play soccer versus how many kids play with fireworks.
Representative Kriesel.
I can have the people that put together the packet come up if you would like to address them.
I mean,
I think we have someone coming down.
I know the point, Mr. Chair, is obviously as he's coming down is to demonstrate that soccer is more dangerous than fireworks. I'm just curious if... because it's 35 times more likely to be injured playing soccer is the point of the handout. Are there 35 times more often that... Anyway, maybe you can just explain the data.
Welcome to the Commerce Committee. Please identify yourself for the record and start when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Matthew Wyatt. I work with a variety of nonprofits, primarily Olive Tree Adoptions here in Minnesota, and also Bridgeview Assembly of God Church. We operate fireworks tents. I've actually had my hands been involved with I and my volunteers for the past 4 years. We've been running fireworks tents throughout Minnesota. Last year we ran 7. We're actually hoping to run 9 this upcoming year. And in that 4 years, we've never had any type of injury. We've never had any type of incident that way. The ability to do this as a fundraiser for us is essential. It's an excellent fundraiser. We typically, in a single location, will raise between $1,500 and $3,000 for our cause, which, as you know, at a time when giving to nonprofits is down, and you know it's harder for everyone to support. It's actually easier to find people to come, go through our safety training. You know, they learn our routines, our exits, and that, you know, those types of things. I apologize, I'm a little I've not done this before.
That's okay, Mr. White. You're doing a good job.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Representative Atkins was asking, did you put together the study? And he was
I apologize. No, I have no direct connection to that study. I was speaking more to.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Kriesel.
Yeah, they're not coming down right now, so okay. I'll just say that on the record that I don't have an answer for you who exactly where they got that, where they put that in there.
Ms. Jerk,
otherwise we'll be here all day. Oh, she's here.
I wasn't trying to give a stumper. This isn't
no, it's
Jeopardy.
Okay. It's okay.
It doesn't have to be asked in the form of a question either. I just was curious. You've got 117,000 injuries from soccer, 3,300 injuries from fireworks, and I'm just curious how many
Jerk,
kids play soccer.
The committee.
Mr. Chair, my name is Valerie Jerk. I represent TNT Fireworks, one of the largest importer of fireworks in the country. That was part of a larger handout that I don't think all got put into the packet, but the idea was that people do things that are that cause risk to you every day. And I can attest to that from a fractured wrist and a fracture in my face from falling up 2 steps at my own house. So, you know, we do risky things every day, and I think it was just pointing out that from a safety standpoint, you know, we don't have a high incident of injury with fireworks, and people do take risks every day in everything that we do.
Thank you, Ms. Jarrett.
And Ms. Chair, all I would suggest to you is that you got 100 and it, the data, what I would like is just some follow-up in terms of how many kids play soccer versus how many play with fireworks, because if you've got 117,000 soccer injuries but 35 million kids play soccer, mm-hmm. it's a very small risk versus
right.
if you have 3,300 kids who play with fireworks or 3,300 injuries and there were 4,000 kids that were playing with fireworks, that would, all that does is defeat what your argument is here. So I'm suggesting it might be helpful to have that information.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, there was more data on that, and it came from a federal agency, actually. So I will pull that whole document together, and I'll make sure that all the members get it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Anybody else want to come down and speak for or against this bill? Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. If you,
no, that's, yeah, that's
please feel free to finish.
Yeah, I guess the point is that our organizations do a lot of good in the community. The ability to sell out of tents gives us the opportunity to fund a lot of the work we do. With our church group, we do every year we hand out backpacks to families who might not be able to afford school supplies. We fill them with school supplies. Last year we raised $4,000 to that effect. We were able to hand out over 1,000 backpacks in the community. You know, people look forward to this. It gives us a chance to love on people, to share with people, to do what we believe the church is supposed to do. And it's just, it's crucial that we be able to sell out of tents. I mean, I have a tent that I run in Eagan right now, and under the normal, the way the law is today, people come in, they look around, you're kind of joking around, oh, where's the fun stuff? And we lose sales to Wisconsin in Eagan. So if some, you know, out-of-state company can come in, open a super center, claim that we're unsafe, even though we care about our community and they're a fireworks company, and then just, you know, well, I'll just go and buy them in, you know, North St. Paul or wherever they build their buildings, it's going to crush us. I mean, so as a fundraising option, it's just going to put us in a really bad place. And so, again, just to reiterate, you know, 4 years doing this, 7 locations, we've never had any type of injury, issue, complaint, concern. And frankly, if there was an issue, I'd rather be trying to get out of a tent than a building, personally. I mean, I'm not a safety expert, but we have 2 very large entrances and exits, and if there was a fire, I imagine my entire tent becomes an exit. So that's really my whole.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wyatt.
Thank you.
Members, any questions for Mr. Wyatt? If not, I think we have our next testifier. Please come up and identify yourself for the record and proceed when you're ready.
My name is Mark Lazarczyk.
Wait,
do you need me to spell that?
Please.
Lazarczyk. I'm the owner of Renaissance Fireworks. I own the largest fireworks company in the state of Minnesota. We had 45 locations last year. I wanted to address the concerns of Phantom Fireworks. They've sent a representative from Ohio here to spread the good news of safety and security to Minnesota, despite the fact that they have thousands of tents set up around the rest of the country. I don't get it. They're here trying to promote that we can't have fireworks in tents, yet they set up thousands of them all around the country, everywhere. The reason is that they want to set up buildings here and isolate the market. Little guys like me could set up 1 or 2 stores around the state because we just don't have the funding to put together buildings that quick and that fast. They, of course, do, being a national company. That's the design around it. They're not concerned about the safety. There's no more safety in a building than there is in a tent. I've seen one incident of a tent ever going up on fire, and it was someone that walked in, lit a firework, put it down on top of the fireworks, and then walked across the street and watched it go up. You can't regulate crazy. Crazy's going to happen. But
God knows we've tried.
Yeah. Well, put those that can. In short, I employ 100 people short-term every year, generally 3 weeks. These are people that need money, and they need it fast. And I give them an opportunity to make a lot of money in a short period of time. People that are behind in their mortgage. We got 10% unemployment out there. I have people with master's degrees working in fireworks tents because they need to pay the bills. I'm all for having as much of this as possible out there. All we're doing right now is losing revenue across the border to the Dakotas and Wisconsin. We're surrounded. By the way, one of the representatives asked about the injury reports out of Wisconsin with fireworks. You're going to have a hard time finding it because Wisconsin doesn't allow them to sell these fireworks to their own citizens. So,
okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Lazarczyk.
You're welcome.
Members, any questions? Anybody else? I know we have at least one more. Mr. Espenson, if you want to come up now and let us know your opinion on the matter. Welcome to the committee, sir. Nice to see you again, and please identify yourself and go ahead when you're ready.
My name is George Espenson. I'm here today to represent the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, the Minnesota Fire Department Association, the Fire Marshals Association of Minnesota, and the International Association of Arson Investigators. You've heard a lot of different information here today about injuries and fires, and I think it's a given that at some level those things are going to increase when you have more dangerous kinds of fireworks allowed in our state. We are in the minority in terms of the kind of fireworks that we allow, but we're also a much safer state for primarily children who wind up being the victims of these kinds of things. What I'd like to touch on today and just give you a couple examples is this is the kind of stuff that's currently is legal in our state. Right now you can go to Costco or Target or whoever sells these and get these kinds of things. These are some of the new things that will be legal. And if you just think of the bottle rockets that maybe back in the old days you might have shot across the yard at your neighbors or your buddies or whatever. This is a much different kind of thing. This goes, you know, maybe 100, 200 feet in the air, can travel quite a distance. And where it lands and if it's fully extinguished or not is going to be the province of the fire service to navigate those kinds of things. What happens now is when you go to the next level, this is one of the things that'll be legal. This is these nine different tubes. They're about 2.5 inches in diameter. There's one single fuse. So once this thing starts, there is no stopping it. So if it's not on a perfectly flat surface, if it slides around a little, it tips over, something bad happens, I mean, you have a lot of BTUs, a lot of energy that's going to go somewhere. And again, this is, you know, way up over the rooftop of your house, wind drift, etc.
Chief Espenson, I hate to interrupt you, but I'm just out of curiosity. I'm not going to hold you to it. Yep. I have no idea. But ballpark, what does something like that cost? Anybody? I'm just.
I think probably a different price at the ballpark.
All right, let's leave the humor to the committee member there.
I'm guessing there might be a couple hundred dollars.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
That's about 79.
79. Okay.
79. Mr. Chair, if you look at the name of it too, I don't know if you can see the name from there.
I don't know that I want to, Representative Nelson.
Pyromania.
All right. Thank you. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I just had no idea. I was curious.
No, that's fine. And I don't profess to be an expert in this stuff. I'm not a big fireworks person personally. It's a little bit of a conflict for me. And last but not least, again, you just imagine the magnitude of this. You light it, and whatever happens after it starts. I mean, I think when we all think about expansion of fireworks, when the common everyday person thinks about it, we're not thinking about going from something like this to an order of magnitude like this. And what I want to talk to you about today most emphatically is that in the world that we all live in, the tough economic times that we live in, and the pressure that's on fire services across Minnesota, where 90% of our fire service is either paid on call or volunteer, we have a tremendous recruitment and retention problem. The aging demographics are working against us. In greater Minnesota, we have small towns where a lot of the jobs are somewhere else, and so we don't have people staying there, the younger kind of firefighter person. And to intentionally pass a bill that's going to create more response, put an additional response burden onto fire departments that are already getting financially strapped, we're resource strapped, especially with 90% of fire departments in our state being, you know, paid on call or volunteer. I just think this is a big mistake. Take all the injuries and the potential, you know, block city blocks burning down. I'm just saying, whether I show up and it's a huge fire or not, I'm going to be called to more events, which costs my taxpayers money, and there's no reimbursement for me showing up at fireworks-driven fires. And just to accentuate that, I think if anyone steps out today outside, you'll see a very brown environment and a very warm environment, and this year in Minnesota, even more particularly, would make these this year in Minnesota even more particularly would make these things much more problematic in our current fire condition. And last, I'd just like to say that I also bring with me opposition as from the League of Minnesota Cities and also the Minnesota Police Chiefs Association.
Thank you, Chief Espenson. Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kriesel, I think this is a question for you. It appears that the name of that is Big John. That's not by any chance named after you already, is it?
Representative Kriesel, we don't have the same rules here as courts, but you don't need to incriminate yourself. Members, any questions for the chief? Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really quickly, in Hudson, say you go right over the border, can we buy that Big John or Pyromaniac or whatever it is?
Yes.
Can we buy that? Okay. Is it illegal to bring it over the border again, or
chief has to
shoot it?
Okay, it's illegal to. So you can buy it, you can bring it back in here, but it's illegal to actually
utilize it.
Light it. Okay, thank you.
And that, Representative Atkins.
That same point. Did I was walking up to visit somebody, but the so you can. Did somebody say up here that you can buy them in Wisconsin? You can't actually shoot them off in Wisconsin?
Chief,
that same, that Big John and stuff, they won't let you shoot it in Wisconsin?
That's correct. Wisconsin has the same law as we
sir, if, can we get you to come down and respond if you...
Sure.
Well, if the chief happens to know, he's...
Well, the chief, if you feel free to respond to that if you...
I don't have all the details.
I think they're out to get us, Mr. Chair. Those Wisconsinites, they want us to bring back this stuff and blow off our fingers here.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. The state of Wisconsin has the same law as Minnesota, safe and sane firework law, with the exception of they allow the local jurisdictions to enforce it. So what happens is when Baldwin, Wisconsin says, well, you guys can sell it, but you just can't sell it to anybody that lives in Wisconsin. And is it any wonder there's 30 fireworks stores within 10 miles of the Minnesota border? There aren't 30 people living within 10 miles of the Minnesota border in Wisconsin. Ooh. If you look at the demographics, Eau Claire is the size of Burnsville. Okay, there aren't people on the western half of Wisconsin. It's completely set up to sell to Minnesotans. Across the river from Red Wing, they actually have signs posted on the doors, no Wisconsin residents allowed.
Thank you, Mr. Lazarczyk. And that, I, never mind, I'll let that one go. If you have to respond to that, please come up, Mr. Hansen. Yes. Mr. Hansen, if you could shed a little light on this, we'd appreciate it. And I, before you do that, I'd like to remind everybody, we need to be out of here at 4:15. So we need to move along here. Mr. Hansen.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. The Wisconsin law is sort of like that. It says that you need a permit, and all you have to do is go down and apply for a permit so the Wisconsin residents can purchase fireworks and shoot them in a specific area on a permit. So it's very, very easy to get a permit for the Wisconsin residents. Now, to address the questions that were asked about this firework that the gentleman brought in, there is a federal law, CPSC, Consumer Products, says 500 grams of pyrotechnic composition is allowed on one base. It doesn't make any difference. The size of the base, it is 500 grams. Now, the Minnesota state law, as it reads right now, allows 500 grams to be sold in the state of Minnesota. It just does not allow it to project a projectile up in the air. So already we're at the 500-gram limit. We're just not allowed to shoot it up into the air. So yeah, I guess the only way, legal way to do it is to light it and throw it up there in the air if you so desire to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Members, any questions? Or Chief Espenson, if you want to add anything to that? Or
well, I'd just like to say that taking a book of matches and throwing those up into the wind is a little different than taking a book of matches and laying them carefully on the sidewalk. There's a much higher probability of destruction. And again, to me, what it is it's about overtaxing our already very strained Minnesota Fire Service. And this is just going to be a natural increase in call load for every fire department in the state. And I think in these times, without funding, which we're constantly under the gun for, I think that's a poor public policy for the fire service.
Thank you, Chief Espenson. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Creasel and Chief Espenson. Nice to see you. I missed you at Rotary on Tuesday. I'm sorry. I had a question. You've been Fire Chief in Eden Prairie for a few years,
yeah,
right?
Almost done.
Okay. So I've noticed in this paper handed out by the League of Minnesota Cities that in 2002 there was some relaxation of our total ban on fireworks, and then in 2008 a little more was done with regards to the amount of explosive. In your experience, what have you seen at Eden Prairie as a result of that? Have things dramatically increased or an increase in injuries or
Chief
incidences?
Espenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Loon. I don't have those statistics, to give you chapter and verse, so I wouldn't want to speculate, but I can tell you anecdotally that, yes, we've had more responses as a result of them and more injuries, but I don't have any data to quantify that. But definitely, every time that meter moves, we get busier and there are more injuries.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to the author, to Representative Kriesel, I'm struggling with this a little bit. I grew up in a rural area in South Dakota where you can shoot off fireworks and that. But, you know, again, I grew up on a farm, and there wasn't anybody around us for quite a while, and there was plenty of area of gravel around it and that to do things. So did you give any thought to the differences in the rural versus suburban areas where in my neighborhood the houses are fairly tight together and we all have shake roofs and this actually happened. They moved now, but one of my neighbor's sons was shooting a fire rockets over my roof, and I was a little concerned about the potential for fire. I thought about any latitude for some of the locales that have those differences.
Representative Kriesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I have considered it. I would be open to looking at the best way of doing that. Again, to point out the fact that it's already illegal to shoot fireworks up in the air in Minnesota, and it happened in your neighborhood. It's something that's already going on. It doesn't make it right, but it's something that they're going over, spending their money in Wisconsin, bringing it over here, already putting strain on the fire departments. And the people generally that are going to shoot off fireworks, these new fireworks, are doing it now. I would be open to looking at a good way to do that.
Representative Loon, follow up?
No, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. To this point, otherwise
on that very point, there's folks that are shooting people in Minnesota, and just because they're doing it doesn't mean that we ought to make it legal. That is exactly the wrong point to make relative to a dangerous mechanism like this. My question goes on that same point, though, and you've got, I found it ironic, Mr. Chairman, that Mr. Johnson from the insurance industry was sitting immediately behind Representative Kriesel on the, as we got in. I just hope that at some point he's going to testify about what the insurance industry's point of view is with respect to making fireworks more available, and particularly aerial fireworks that can be shot off in the fashion that Representative Loon described. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Representative Kriesel.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, we need to compare apples to oranges. Comparing pointing a gun at somebody and shooting and pulling the trigger is not even remotely close to shooting off fireworks. Let's be honest here. So that's, well, I mean, that's...
Mr. Chair, when we're talking about two dangerous, and I'm very sensitive to shooting a gun, I'm also very sensitive to something like fireworks that I've seen blow off a child's hand. They're both very serious, and what your point was to Representative Loon, Representative Kriesel, was that in the event, just because it's happening, that we should make it legal. That's not a very good argument to stand behind any sort of dangerous object that we're talking about. And so, yes, I don't think we're talking apples to oranges at all. I think we're absolutely apples to apples on that comparison. Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome, Representative Atkins. Representative Kriesel, to that point. Otherwise, Representative Dietrich had another question.
We'll move on.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kriesel, I would just like to talk with you a little bit about a different approach, because I am the mother of three boys, and so I do have experience with illegal fireworks. And I do know...
Representative Dietrich, we're all wondering, are you using those, or are the boys, or...
Well, it's a family affair.
Well, enjoy your time in Wisconsin.
We do. I did not know that they couldn't use them, though. I thought we were just traveling there. So anyhow, I do agree with the fact that prohibition doesn't work. It's in their genes, I think. So anyhow, when my husband and I, celebrate with the boys on 4th of July with fireworks and that type of stuff, you do feel guilty breaking the law. And so... What we have always wondered is, why doesn't the state of Minnesota, and so I'm here right now, look at, if you want to expand fireworks or not make criminals out of kids just trying to have fun, is there another approach to take? And one approach that we had always thought would be is to allow licensing of a fireworks display, which would, you know, require, for example, like on our property, it's you know, pretty open and big, and so, you know, we have room to shoot them, and it's under parental guidance, and we have, you know, a you know, hoses going down to the area that they're doing them, and all sorts of precautionary things. Is there a way to at least allow those people who want to do it, who want to engage in a little bit of fireworks around the 4th of July, to do it legally and safely? And the idea of licensing, you know, that they are in a either a rural area or a wide open space, or that, and the other thing that we often thought too of is just a training class. If kids want to engage in something that dangerous, just like firearms, then they should have to engage in some level of training on how to use them and what are types of precautions would they take if something got out of control or something like that.
Representative Kreisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dietrich, very valid points, things I will look at going forward. Thank you.
Members, any other questions? Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to come down? Sir, come on down. And again, members, we need to be out of here. We have session at 4:30. We need to be done in about 8 minutes. So, and Representative Sanders needs 6 minutes to do both of his bills. So, sir, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and start when you're ready.
My name is Trent Block, D-L-O-C-K.
Okay.
I just had some data to answer some questions from various representatives. To the point from Representative Loon, State Fire Marshal publishes fire data. And in 2007, there were 175 fires caused by fireworks in Minnesota. In 2008, there were 123, 2009, 92, and 2010, 45. So it has been trending downward. To Representative Atkins about fireworks injuries, Indiana publishes their data. Prior to 2006, they only had safe and sane or ground-based like us. In 2004, they had 233 injuries. 2005, they didn't report, the law lapsed. 2006, they legalized aerial fireworks, like this bill, which was 251 injuries, and then 156 injuries the next year, 141 injuries the next year, and in 2009, it's 116 injuries. So it's been trending downward in that state as well. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate the enlightenment. Other questions from members? Is there anyone else who would like to speak for or against the bill? Mr. Block, you get the brevity award. We appreciate that. It was enlightening and quick. Thank you. With that, I'm not seeing anyone else. Representative Stensrud will Representative Kreisel will give you the final word.
Just would appreciate your support on this bill.
With that, Representative Stensrud will renew his motion that House File 1774, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Kreisel. Members, I hate to say this, but I think we're going to have to come back tonight. What's that? We'll be room 118 in the Capitol, which I'm devoutly hoping is not this warm. And we'll meet about 6:15. And the other bills, we've got three left on the agenda that should be relatively quick.
Yeah.
So I hate to do that, but I think we are in recess until 6:15. Thank you, members. What's that? 6:15. 6:15. Room 118 in the Capitol.
118 in the Capitol.
We do. We have some. We will reconvene the Commerce and Regulatory Committee, Reform Committee, and Representative Sanders, you have a bill of 2554.
23.
We'll consider at this point. Representative Sanders, would you allow to move your bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm not sure if this can go straight to the General Register, if there's another spot. I guess I need to do that. So I have the impression that this can go straight to the General Register. Is that correct? That'll be my motion.
Right.
We'll move House File 2354. We recommend the pass and be sent to the General Register. I do have a delete all amendment, but I'll also move at this time. It is labeled the DG1. We sent it out during the last committee meeting. Everyone should have it. But if the committee would indulge, I'd like to adopt the DG1 and then discuss.
All right, Representative Sanders, if you want to go ahead and move your DE1 amendment. Right, to get the bill in the form that the author wants, we'll consider the DE1 amendment to 2354 DE1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Representative Sanders, your bill is in the order that you want. Proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is before us, and I had a testifier from the industry that was here during the last committee, but we weren't able to get to him in that time. But we have an issue with, basically some inconsistency that was felt from city to city and across county to county based upon the building inspector's interpretation of the code when putting in sump pumps. So we have worked to come up with some language that we hope kind of clarifies the code, and we believe from this that we do have the checkoff from the pipe trades, the plumbing contractors, and have not heard of anyone that opposes the DE1 amendment that we just adopted to this point in time. I know that Mr. Thayden is here, if anyone would like to verify that, if I'm incorrectly. As the amendment states, we wanted to clarify and make sure that it didn't necessarily have to have a full-blown license to install residential cell phones.
Representative Anzels, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, this pertains only to residential, not commercial, and it only pertains to single-family dwellings, right?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anzels, that is my intention, and I don't know if we want to clarify with Mr. Kremer, Ms. Newman, I guess, to make sure. I believe that it's in the correct chapter to only apply. She's nodding her head yes. Mr. Fayden is why.
Mr. Fayden, if you will state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Gary Fayden. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association, which includes plumbing contractors, and representative, yes, it does. It's residential and existing residential single-family dwelling.
Good.
Oh. All right. Other member questions? If not, is there anyone from the public who would like to speak for or against, or others who would like to testify on the matter before the committee this evening? Seeing none, we will close the testimony. Representative Sanders,
motion that House File 2354 as amended be recommended pass and placed on the general register.
All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Representative Sanders, you also have House File 2136, if you'd like to move that for the committee consideration.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm with House File 2136, also, I believe, is being sent to the General Register by the Transportation.
And there is a... Representative Sanders.
Mr. Chair, I guess... Before we go any farther, I'll amend my motion. You need to send this to Ways and Means.
Okay. So we will go to Ways and Means instead of the General Register on 2136. There was also an amendment in our packet. Is that your A1 amendment as well?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, we can do it now. I'll move the A1 amendment. All this amendment does, Mr. Chair, if I can proceed, is...
Please do, Representative Sanders.
Basically say that insurance identification can now be provided electronically. You can have your insurance, physical insurance in electronic format. It does not change anything of its permissive language, but paper is still the default. But if you would like to have electronic format with insurance, this amendment will allow you to do it. I think it's a good direction to move it.
Right. Representative Sanders moves the A1 amendment to House File 2136. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the bill is in the form that the author wants. Continue. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2136 delete all in transportation. What this bill now does is it amends the definition of a high-value vehicle from $5,000 to $9,000. And a little background there, that don't have the exact date, but I believe that that $5,000 range was entered into statute sometime in the 1980s. So we're bringing that currency around $9,000. Late model vehicle, we're changing that definition by comparing the designated model year with the current calendar year. And sometimes cars, like in 2012, probably September, October time, you can already purchase a 2013 model car. So we're moving from a model year to a calendar year. The older model vehicle to consist of all vehicles that have a model year that is older than those of a late model vehicle. Modify salvage title statute that says the time the insurance company has before it gets required to notify driver and vehicle services. So that notification must occur within 10 days of obtaining the vehicle title. Raise the cutoff for self-insured vehicle owners from any amount of vehicle damage from an accident, say 70% to 80% of actual cash value. But we are also eliminating the exclusion of airbag replacement costs from the calculation of the vehicle damage. So it is our intention, understanding that this is basically a push. That again, back when this statute was written, not all vehicles had airbag systems. Now almost all do. So we should bring that current, move that actual cash value to 80% and now actually include the airbag systems in that as well. So with that, if there's any other questions, I do have Mr. Wally here. If there are any technical questions, I don't know if you address anything. Otherwise, we'll stand for questions.
Mr. Wally, did you want to make a statement to the committee?
In the interest of brevity, I'll stand for questions.
Right. Any member questions for Representative Sanders or Mr. Wally on 2136 as amended? Seeing none, anyone from the public or anyone here wishing to testify on either for or against this? Seeing none. Representative Sanders, if you want to renew your motion.
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion. House File 2136 be recommended to pass.
As amended?
As amended, it will be sent to the committee.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries. This time I will turn the meeting over to Representative Sanders as the chair.
Dan.
Let's give it to him.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Benson. You can introduce yourself for the record. Is there any member that has a bill in front of them that would like to move the bill? I can as soon as I find it, unless you have. Representative Mazeroff has moved Representative Benson's bill. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members. House File 2233. I'm going to give the reason why I'm bringing the bill, and I'm going to turn over the testimony to Mr. Mark Kenny from Minnesota Service Cooperatives. For me, it's a bill that just adds competition and hopes to allow for greater flexibility with small businesses to be able to secure better, cheaper health insurance for their employees. Start with, I work at a small Christian college in Rochester, Minnesota, and we labor under some, there's only about 25 to 30 people in any given semester at school for the health insurance that is provided by the college with some extremely high insurance rates. And so I began looking for some way that we might be able to bend down that cost. A couple of years ago, I actually served for a little while as the director of human resources there, and had a good friend that worked at the service cooperative in Rochester, Southeast Service Cooperative. We had some conversation, what should be great if there was a way that we could pool and find a better way to drive down, not just for the college that I work for, but any small business in our community. Then I have a men's group that meets at the Perkins in Rochester every Tuesday when I'm not here, and got to be friends with the gal that serves our meals when we're there for breakfast. And talking with her, you know, Perkins is not able to offer any kind of real package because of the cost. She's 62 years old. She's been at Perkins for 31 years and pays $1,400 a month for health insurance. There's got to be a way that we can begin to help and look for ways, avenues to help with small business costs on insurance and get more. I know there's a high percentage of Minnesotans that have health insurance, but there's got to be a way to help more small business to be able to afford providing as some kind of a benefit to employees, benefits that undoubtedly that the employer eventually going to pay for. But that was my impetus to bring this to in bill form, and was able to, of course, then find someone through the service cooperatives that was interested in providing a bill. I've come to find out that this is the bill that was first introduced in 2006 by a representative from St. Cloud's, Representative Knobloch. So I'm bringing it back for your reconsideration for this bill. Now, turn over the technical explanation of what the bill will do, and
Real quick, Ms. Representative Benson, Representative Anzels has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this to me lines up pretty closely to Representative Gottwald's legislation the other day, where he's taking something really good in the public sector and trying to jerry-rig it to work in the private sector. But in this case, service co-ops are public entities, and you're trying to include religious organizations as well as private sector businesses in what is a health delivery primarily intended for public employees. Do you find any conflict with any of that?
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Anzel, no, I don't. And in terms of religious organizations, such as the college that I work for, I guess I'm assuming that's what you're referring to. If they don't elect or decide to belong to a pool because they're afraid they may have to take some part of a plan that they don't like, they don't have to join the pool. So there's no forcing, there's no mandates. It's just whether or not they want to pool together with other people and hopefully providing an opportunity to drive down their costs.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, I won't belabor the point, but on the one hand, I'm pleased to see your acceptance of the public option in the delivery of health care, but I'm not quite sure that this fits either in your case a private religious higher educational institution or a private business. So I guess I got to learn a little bit more from the co-op.
Thank you, Representative Anzels. And with that, we'll move on to the testifier. If you would welcome, or if you would state your name for the record and proceed, that'd be great.
My name is Mark King, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the service cooperatives. I'm a private attorney. I've been working with the service cooperatives for the past dozen years on various projects. Before we jump to the bill, let me spend just a minute or two talking about the service cooperatives and what they do.
Real quick, sir, before you get rolling here, would you mind spelling your name for us just so we have correct spelling?
K-I-M-M-E-Y.
Perfect. Thank you. Go ahead.
The service cooperatives are local units of government, and they are empowered under Minnesota law to aggregate buying power on behalf of cities, counties, and school districts. And the primary service that they provide, at least if you measure it by the economic value, is health care in the state of Minnesota. They currently pool together approximately 600, more than 600 cities, counties, and school districts. And through an RFP process that is conducted every 4 years, they buy down health insurance, typically in their own pool, or they get administrative services through their own pool for their own members. These are entities that do not take tax money from Minnesota. They are a free market governmental entity, probably unique in the state and maybe in the country for all I know. The thing that distinguishes them, the seven that I work with, can use, they're basically controlled through local boards, so that the plans that are delivered in different parts of the state vary depending on the geography, the local bargaining history. It provides a fairly custom solution, but it's effective. The just by example, we just completed an RFP for the school pool, about 340 school districts in the state, and we had two of the largest carriers in the state competing for that business head-to-head for a number of months. When those final numbers came in, they were within 1% to each other statewide on approximately more than $1 billion in premiums measured over 4 years. And that, to me, to many people, would validate that we got to the lowest cost, but we didn't stop there. We took them back and said, you're tied, what else can you do? The winner of that bid reduced their administrative fees by 7%. They saved approximately $3.5 million. They put 25% of their administrative fees at risk for performance guarantees. They capped premiums on stop-loss insurance at medical CPI and gave us various other concessions. And that's the type of experience we can bring to this market. We've been doing it in the public sector market for 25 years. Now, the idea of a marriage of a public entity like this and a private sector, I don't think that it's, I think it's a good thing. And the reason I think it's a good thing is because the political subdivision represented the service property were subject to open meeting laws. They're subject to the Sunshine Act. They're not a private profit-making entity. They're a governmental entity. So what goes on in their meetings throughout the state is public information. And as an organizing principle for aggregating buying power for private employers, it's proven effective. The model has worked in the public sector. We think it can work in the private sector as well. The bill itself, it's simple, it's short, but it's divided into two parts, and let me briefly touch on that. One would contemplate the service providers would run some kind of a self-insured pool. That, I don't think, is a realistic option for the service cooperatives, because to be self-insured with multiple private employers, you would have what's called a multiple employer welfare arrangement, or a MEWA. And MEWAs are regulated in the same way as insurance companies in the state of Minnesota. The service cooperatives don't have the reserves for that. They wouldn't have, you know, absent some future act of the legislature, that's not a viable option. That doesn't mean I think that should be taken out of the bill. It's good to have this possibility out there in the future. But that's not where the service cooperatives would be able to provide service right away. It's the second part of this bill where the service cooperatives can run a fully insured multiple employer welfare arrangement. All they would be doing is acting, would be administering the request for proposal process. They'd be doing what we currently do throughout the state for all of our public employer clients. But we would be able to have an opportunity to get these small employers together, aggregate their buying power, and drive down rates. Now, I know that the insurance companies are not going to be in favor of this for that reason. However, these folks, if you talk about the fully insured side, they're going to be paying extra premiums, they're going to be paying premium taxes. There's no special sweetheart deal that the service providers are asking for here. All we're trying to do is harness free market forces in an environment that is fully disclosed to the public under the Sunshine Law that applies to government lines.
Thank you, Mr. Kinney. We appreciate the testimony. I'm going to jump right ahead to Representative Anzels, who had a couple questions. You'll pass for now. Any other questions from members at this point? Representative Stensrud.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, I'm not as familiar with service cooperatives. On average, is there a certain number of lives that they typically represent when negotiating with an insurance company?
Mr. Kinney.
Sure. The pool itself represents altogether about 50,000 employees in the state of Minnesota. Not including their dependents and spouses. And I think, hands down, it's the most effective public employer plan in the state and probably the nation. And the reason for that is that we rely on free market principles. We rely on innovation. The service cooperatives were the first entity in the state of Minnesota to offer health reimbursement arrangements to public employees funded through an individual trust. were funded through trusts, and that permitted employers throughout the state to move the plan to have more cost sharing and allow employees to have skin in the game. You were probably the first indication. I mean, this happened in 2001 at the time we went through the IRS and private letter ruling process. This has become the norm. And we were miles ahead of the local carriers in the state in providing this innovative new benefit. So, I mean, they've been doing a wonderful job here for our schools and our cities and counties. And the evidence of that is the fact that these are voluntary rules. Any, you know, if Blue Cross or Medica or anyone else wants to come up and take away a group, they're free to give it their best shot. And these groups have held together for 25 years because we're helping the lowest cost coverage.
Thank you.
So that's a pretty long answer.
Very good. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the witness. Service cooperatives have been around for a long time. They started out selling paper clips and copy paper and erasers. Then they got in the insurance business. And now, basically what this bill does, and correct me if I'm wrong, you basically want to become a big general agency that would compete against insurance agents. Is that correct?
Mr. Kenny.
The bill would permit... You know, insurance agents, it says it must permit the sale of its products by insurance producers as defined in 60K31. So there would be opportunities to pay commissions to insurance producers who are involved in this as well.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and to the witness, what do we need you for? This is already being done in the marketplace. Agents go out and bid for business, and the free market is out there to drive down prices the way it is. Why do we need you in the business?
Mr. Kinney.
Well, I view the service cooperatives as, I mean, it's one of many options out there, but they're an organizing principle. The service cooperatives have 25 years of experience running these multiple employer arrangements, and they've been very effective at it. There's expertise throughout the state. I just think that as an organization, we're particularly well-suited to do this sort of work out there.
Chair Davis.
Mr. Chairman, to the witness, I don't know why we need you in this business. You're not really, you may lower costs. I don't know how you're lowering costs because companies that are looking for a bid can go get the bids today. You're not doing anything in this bill to say we're capping costs for hip surgeries or anything like that. It's just you want to become a big insurance agent. Bigger than you already are. You're huge right now. In the public sector, I don't understand why we need you.
Mr. Kinney?
I guess just the aggregation of buying power of more than one employer, I think has been proven to be effective in the public sector. I think it can work in the private sector. We're not the end-all, be-all solution, but I think that letting us loose in this space only going to help drive down healthcare costs to the extent we can make it work. And that's to be determined. But I don't see the harm in what it's trying.
So, Mr. Chairman, to the witness, so in other words, you said agents. So would the agents be working for you?
Mr. Kinney?
The statute says that the pool authorized must permit the sale of its products by insurance producers as defined in 60K. I don't know. We didn't work that detail out. I think the agents would still be working for the employers. And in placing them in the pool, and the agents, if they believe that they can find better coverage for their employers someplace else, right, there's no prohibitions on them moving them from the pool. But the service cooperatives work with agents today routinely with their member employers. And those employers typically will pay those insurance agents their fees. So I think that's how that would work here as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, to the witness, I am a licensed insurance agent,
okay.
So just for full disclosure, but if I'm going to go to ABC Company, and now I not only compete against the other insurance agents, now you're going to be in the mix too? I don't want you there. Why do I want you? Go away.
Mr. Kinney.
I'm not sure, I'm not here to testify about what's best for the insurance agents. I'm here to testify what's best for private employers trying to control their health insurance costs in the state.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to the witness, I'm already doing that every day. That's what I do. Why do I want you in the way? I don't understand this.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Benson.
I started with just the fact that if we need to bend down the cost to small organizations and small business, and if they can help do that, and because they're adding another element of competition, so the only barrier to that would be that the people that they would compete with are would be afraid that they could do that. If this was a perfect world, we would see that level of competition already, and we wouldn't have private small businesses looking for answers to reduce our insurance costs.
Well, Chair Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill doesn't control insurance costs. It has nothing to do with what the price of my quadruple bypass surgery costs. And I don't think insurance agents are afraid. I'm not afraid of anything except maybe wear some Advil or something. I'm really not. I'm not afraid. It's just that, and I'm not afraid of Mr. Advil. You're a great guy. But I'm not afraid of anything. But I just don't know why we need you.
Mr. Kinney?
Because you're not controlling health care costs. The bill does nothing to control health care costs. The competition's already there in the market. It looks like, it just makes me think of, what do you want next? First of all, it's paper clips. Then you go to copy paper. Then you go to erasers. Now you're huge in the health insurance business, and now you want to get going against private insurance agents. Why would we do that?
Mr. Kinney?
As I previously testified, we're not against private insurance agents. And secondly, where we have been able to reduce health care costs in the public sector is by getting small employers to go on to uniform plan designs, for example, to simplify the administration of the plans. A claim is a claim, but the administrative fee and the employers and the insurance company's profit are areas where the larger the client, the better deal that we will get. And if we can present all these small employers with one single large buying block, it's our belief that we can drive down healthcare costs, and we can also help in innovating plan designs that are more likely to have an impact on reduced health care.
Well, thank
you. To the questioner,
Representative Benson.
Why did they get as big as they did? Because they have value. They were able to do and deliver the kinds of savings that these businesses, or these school districts, I should say, and municipalities expected. That's how they got big.
Mr. Chairman, there's a lot more to that on how they got big, and I'm not going to go on that because I have tremendous respect for this author, and if we didn't have the author here that we have, I would actually be displaying some concerns about this bill.
I guess just be glad you don't have a tax provision in this bill.
I'm going to amend some tax stuff on
it. Representative Anzels, you're next on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I too share respect and admiration for the author, but the blended nature of this between the public and the private sector confused me a bit and made me a little nervous. Secondly, on a bad day, this feels to me almost as though we're socializing private sector healthcare by co-opting what public sector workers have because they are in a public environment which exists because of the public paying taxes. But having said that, aren't there opportunities already for the seven private sector employers that I have in my district? That's supposed to be a joke.
It's funny now.
Can't they already pool in order to provide health care to their workers? Or couldn't they form some kind of an employer association which would enable them to take advantage of some
statutory allowances for pooling. Or how about this? Aren't there opportunities for a group of private sector employers to sign a collective bargaining agreement with a union and take advantage of Taft-Hartley healthcare provisions, which have been around for a long, long, long time?
Representative Benson or Mr. Kenny?
Yes, there are opportunities like that. If employers want to unionize, they can participate in a Taft-Hartley trust. Private sector employers there are opportunities for them to pool their and participate in an arrangement like this. Most private sector employers aren't focused on creating and managing these pools because they're focused on their business. But what we can provide is some expertise and experience in the process.
Well, Mr. Chair, there are third-party administrators who do this very thing in both the public and the private sector. So I have some trouble with the bill.
Thank you, Representative Van Zels. Representative Stenzer, do you still have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author and testifiers. As a small employer myself for the last 10 years, I wished I had access to the kind of insurance rates that have been negotiated for these, you know, service cooperatives. I mean, they sort of, when I talk to insurance agents, they sort of snicker and say, well, you know, how many guys you got? And I say, well, it's me, my office manager, and, well, maybe, I don't know who else might want to join in. So when you have a half a dozen people, there are no options. They're very expensive plans, and they're hard to find. So if I could join some sort of a cooperative, I think that would be a good thing to entertain. And if that's one more option we have, I'm kind of pleased to look at some of these different ideas to sort of grapple with some of the costs and the increasing healthcare costs we have.
Representative Benson or Mr. Kinney?
Well, I'm not sure if that was more of a question.
More of a comment.
Sure.
I guess I tend to agree. I think that the more we can put out there that helps to push down costs, the better. Maybe this would work. Maybe it wouldn't. By creating a combining forces and combining and aggregating buying power, it's going to help private employers in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Kinney. Representative Atkins?
Just a couple quick questions. First off, capitalization. I assume you're not going to use the capital that underlies your current pool to...
No.
Mr. Kinney?
This bill says that the pools cannot be combined, so there was no question of any of the other pools doing anything on this side.
So do you need... Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kinney, where do you get the capital from? Are you just sitting on a big pile of money, or are you going to go out into the markets to try to find it?
Mr. Kinney?
Well, we're not going to try to create the reserves to create a self-funded pool. That's where it would require an enormous amount of capital. All we would be doing here is organizing within our communities. The seven service offices are located all throughout the state. These people know small businesses in each of the small towns in which they operate that would love to participate in these arrangements. Once we get people interested in participating, that's free. The next step would be doing an RFP and trying to get as many employers as we can together. I think it would start pretty small, but just as the service cooperative started, I think it would grow if we could show results. Again, it'd be voluntary. It doesn't work for you. If you're not getting lower rates, you don't have to stay. So what's the harm if we can't give an opportunity to improve it?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I gather from that answer the capitalization is actually through the Blues or through somebody else, not through you guys.
Right.
Mr. Kinney.
All we're doing is selecting the insurance carrier, one or more, whoever we set things up to provide that service.
And Chair or Representative Atkins.
I like Chair. That's fine.
It was for 2 years for me.
The next issue, and I guess to some degree I understand Representative David's concern about why you guys, why not anybody, why not, you know, we're pretty smart folks when it comes to insurance. Maybe we could pull some folks together and get some aggregate buying power that Representative Stensrud and I, as small business owners, are both looking for. But I appreciate the sentiment in trying to aggregate that. The next question I would have, though, is about governance. Right now I believe it's like school board members and stuff. Are they going to be the ones that would sit on, you set up a separate board that isn't necessarily spelled out in the statute here, or would it be those existing people that would then have the say over private sector health insurance?
Mr. Kinney.
We would want to retain our status as public employers, and I think it's important to the process because then we have the sunshine laws, the open meeting laws. What we would most likely do is set up advisory committees of the private sector pools, and that's how they would have their say. Where we operate throughout the state, the influence of local advisory committees has a huge impact on the plan designs we make available. In Northeast, they're richer because of the long history of the mining and the heavy unionization in that area. Southwestern Minnesota tends to be a little bit more not as rich of a plan, but each local area is influenced by the local needs and desires and their ability to pay. So, yes, we would be influenced. There would be advisory committees, but the governance model wouldn't be pushed off the public sector model.
Representative Atkins.
That's an interesting. I would have pictured it otherwise. I would have anticipated that you would set up, if you've got Representative Stensrud and I putting in a bunch of money, that we would have an opportunity to potentially serve on that, or would be the sort of people you'd want to have serve on the board, as opposed to a public sector employer whose challenges are entirely different than Representative Stensrud and myself, that your board would be a separate entity that would represent those people that are buying insurance through it. But that was, I'm glad I asked the question, put it that way.
Mr. Kinney?
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to look at the board, the compositions of the boards currently. I believe, though, that we would need to keep it as public sector.
This is a mess. I don't have, are you done, Representative Atkins, with that line? I don't have anybody on the list to testify, but I will. I see Mr. McLaren and Mr. Freeman rising, so we'll open it up. If there's anyone that would like to testify, please make your way forward, introduce yourself, and make your we'll certainly give you time, but please make your comments as concise as possible. That'd be a big help.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jay McLaren, and I'm the Director of Government Relations at Medica, and I'm here to testify in opposition to the bill. Real quick, I just want to start off by giving a little bit of background on pooling. There's a lot of talk and discussion in the committee about pooling and what it means. One of the primary functions that we serve in the marketplace is the pool. When small businesses join and buy into our insurance, they are accessing, for example, Medica, the approximately 1 million customers that we serve, the fully insured market. So they take advantage of that pool now. Unfortunately, when it comes to a lot of, well, and to give you an idea that we base, and a lot of our risk is based on our pool. So obviously we have a lot of customers who have no claims in a year, but they still pay for it. We have a lot of customers who have very high claims. They don't pay the full cost of those claims. They pay a premium that's more towards the middle. And unfortunately for a lot of folks who believe that they may be able to get a better premium by being able to combine their purchasing power, that may not be true. It's about the risk in that pool. Thankfully for us and for our competitors in this marketplace, the people who buy insurance through us take advantage of that pool to be able to keep the increases or perhaps even increases in premiums relatively smooth compared to if they were on them. I just want to follow up to some of the questions that have been asked. Quite frankly, we have a lot of questions about what this bill is or isn't. Just because the language in the bill is so vague. I mean, I appreciate the comments from the service cooperatives that they don't intend to self-fund and some of the questions from the committee. But, you know, obviously the bill would allow them to self-fund.
So if they are fully insured, exactly how would that work? This bill doesn't answer a lot of the questions that are usually answered if a cooling bill comes before the legislature. There are a number of different examples of these bills that have come before you, and there are a number of questions that aren't answered. For example, how would you insure against cherry picking? They don't have some sort of requirements for the businesses that would enter. If this is to fully insure them, how would they be rated? Would each individual business be rated as a small business? Would they be rated as a large group? Exactly how would that work? We don't exactly know. And at the same time, what are the consumer protections that would be applied to these folks? Those are a number of different questions that we have that aren't really answered in the bill because it's just one paragraph. One of my biggest points, the last point that I want to make has to do with if they do take advantage and do fully insure, or I'm sorry, if they do self-fund the businesses that would join. You've heard a lot of testimony from folks who have come before the committee who are concerned about the shrinking fully insured marketplace. We're almost at about 25% of Minnesotans are in the fully insured market. It continues to dwindle and dwindle year after year. So that means that a lot of the taxes and assessments that are applied to the fully insured market to pay for things like our state high risk pool and pay for some other things through the premium tax, if they're allowed to take these businesses and include them in a self-funded pool, it would further erode that tax base. And I know you've heard from us, you've heard from the chamber, you've heard from others about their concerns with that. So we're concerned about it from a tax standpoint, but also, obviously, if they're exempt from state taxes and they have a relatively similar risk profile to our pool, it would automatically have a competitive advantage over us because they'd be exempt from those state taxes. So those are the three primary points I wanted to make, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. McLaren. Members, any questions? Seeing none, we'll move on to the next testifier.
I have a lot to add to what Mr. McLaren said. I'm Robert Friedman from Health Partners. I do want to add that we did have an opportunity to chat with Representative Benson, who was very gracious in his time. We had a good conversation, but I think there's still a lot of questions that we still have to answer and work through.
Any questions, members, at all? Seeing none, thank you both for your testimony. Appreciate it. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none. Representative Benson, you want to add some more comments or follow up on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thank the committee for the opportunity to present it. I think although there may be some issues we need to work through that were brought up, I still think it's a good bill and that it would provide another opportunity for competition in the marketplace where there is strength, numbers there are strength, and it gives individuals that don't have the skill set as small businesses to manage insurance pool, gives them another opportunity to pool together and potentially lower the rates.
Thank you, Representative Benson. We appreciate this. At this point in time, we're going to lay the bill over. And with that, we thank everyone. We will adjourn and then meet back on Tuesday.